Good afternoon, everyone. Brett Henderson here, looking forward to another exciting episode of the Veteran Entrepreneur Masterclass. Today's guest is Alex Chumpf. And Alex, you and I connected recently on LinkedIn, and I just always ask everyone as a guest, are you a client of mine?
No.
Okay. Am I paying you to be on here to say anything?
Not that I'm aware of.
Not yet, right? So maybe dinner or drink sometime. I just saw on the news there was a big sinkhole in Chatsworth that like ate a car. It's kind of crazy. I don't know if you saw that. Literally like half the road's gone and just a car just really bad. So look out for sinkholes if you're driving around the valley. So try not to drive around the valley in the first place. You'll probably be better, right?
We got a lot of weather up here too.
Where are you, Al? I don't even know where you are. Where are you right now? That's the best thing.
I'm in El Dorado Hills, California. We lost about 100 feet of fence line so far. So we'll see how the rest of the week treats us.
Do you have any animals that you use the fence line for, or are they kind of historic now?
No, just, a regular residential property. And, my dog goes out in the backyard, but not anymore.
Understood.
The dog won't come back. Put him on a leash. Put him on a leash for a little while.
Good. Well, let's jump into it today. So this is interesting. So you and I connected on LinkedIn again, and you chatted about your area of expertise. But before we talk about that, this is going to be an episode in our education series. So this is for veteran entrepreneurs who are seeking to really obtain capital or to know or to have help with a thought process in considering on the ability to potentially take on capital to grow your business. And so, Alex, that's why I thought you'd be a phenomenal speaker to come on here. You've got the experience. I can already tell. And you and I are just connecting the first time here on video. So that you're very mellow guy. So your energy will balance out my energy very nicely. So this is going to be a good podcast. So why don't you take a couple minutes just to introduce us kind of when you were in the Marine Corps, what you did, and we'll just go with that to start, please.
Sure. So I went into the Marine Corps in 1991. And I was following in my father's footsteps. So my father is a Marine veteran from the Vietnam era. And I was an 0311 in the Marine Corps. So for your listeners who may not be familiar with that, that's a standard load-bearing pack animal with a rifle.
Grunt.
That's a grunt, yes. So my specialty in the Marine Corps from an MOS perspective is what they call an 8152. So I was an 0311, 8152, which meant that I specialized in close quarter battle and physical security.
What was your favorite weapon system you got to play with back in the day?
Well, that's a really good question. You know, it's just a tool. You use the tool for the job. I did guard nuclear weapons that was my first tour of duty. So I started off as a nuclear weapons security guard and moved my way up to becoming what's called the PRP chief, or personnel reliability program chief of that installation. So it's kind of a senior enlisted man in charge of the security for that installation, which was interesting because I was only an E3 at the time, actually. So
that's a lot of responsibility.
Yeah, it could sound like I had a plan, but I didn't. I was your typical young Marine. There's nothing particularly special or noteworthy about me. I would do my job during work hours and then go out with my friends and get into trouble my off duty time. I didn't have much aspiration beyond being good at what I did. And, you know, I was pleased and honored to have been identified for that responsibility. And after that, I went to the East Coast. I went to the Fleet Marine Force, first to 1-2 and then 2-6. But really, for most of that time, I was actually in Guantanamo Bay, working with refugees, first Haitian and then Cuban refugees during the 1994-1995 period, when President Bill Clinton was, you know, as a matter of foreign policy, reinstalling Aristide back into Haiti. And then subsequently, Fidel Castro made the decision to allow anybody who wanted to leave Cuba to leave Cuba, you know, so we had a lot of Haitian and a lot of Cuban refugees, probably about 50,000 of them total, that ended up in Guantanamo Bay, where initially I served as a security person for United Nations personnel, and then worked as both a translator and a computer operator, and then later on came back with 2-6 for riot control. And after that, I came home, and that was 1995. So I went in an E1, I came out an E4, then it was time to come home and start my professional life.
Awesome. Well, thank you for sharing your history there. I think I remember my master guns when I checked the second tanks had been down in Gitmo. We had tanks in Cuba. I don't think many people knew that, but we actually had some tanks down there. Riot control, I never got to do it, but I remember the training aspect for it was super fun when you had all the gear on and you're stomping and grunting as you're coming to address the angry mob. It was kind of impressive at the same time. So you got to do some fun stuff.
Sure. It was a necessary duty. And I'd like to think that everybody around me conducted themselves with honor and did their very best to be as supportive and helpful as we could be for the refugees who were in a difficult situation. And then when things became difficult and dangerous for the refugees and for the other people in Guantanamo Bay, we did what was necessary to restore order, but always with an eye toward the greater good.
Good. Well, I like your position then. So that's great. So then you went from being a Marine and then obviously worked your path now towards entrepreneurship. So why don't you share a little bit more about what you and your company does now?
Well, I'll do that. But before I do that, I should tell you that when I met my wife in 1995, and she and I have been married since 97, so we just celebrated our 26th anniversary.
Congratulations.
But since we're talking on a veterans podcast, it's useful to know that her brother was in the 101st and her father was on the Army Rifle Team.
Oh, wow.
So a long tradition. It's also worth mentioning that many of my co-founders in my different endeavors are veterans. So we do a lot of work with veterans and we do a lot of work for veterans. So
let's address that. How did your mindset come about, or how did you make that decision? Because you can go into business with civilians or veterans, right? We can all do that. How was that part of your decision-making process, or how did that process happen where you look back now like, yeah, I've been working with veterans for many years since I got out. How was that? Was there a decision tree or just felt natural and you just had the trust, or do you mind walking us through that process? Because I think a lot of us are faced with that same choice. We want to get a business up and running. So I go with Joe Schmo, who's a civilian, or another veteran. Doesn't have to be with my branch or service, but they're a veteran nonetheless.
Sure. That's a really good question. I would say I've become more intentional about it over the years. You know, the first veteran I ever worked with in 1995 was actually my father, because my father owns several patents in the telecommunications space. He's a retiree from the phone company. So when I first came home in 1995, I worked at his business, initially running cable, and then later on I launched a network services company. So it was accidental in the beginning, or family in the beginning. But as time went on, particularly in the last 10 years or so, it's been much more by design. And what I've learned over the years, Brett, is that, and I know this won't be news for people, but it's worth saying, you know, running a business with someone is like being married. And it helps to have a common set of values. It helps to have a common understanding about what constitutes good work, what constitutes moral action. And it's important, I think, to be aligned with the people around you. So, you know, later on in my career, it became much more deterministic, much more intentional. And I would say it's without any regrets. It's been a very good thing to do. These days, I pretty much won't work with anybody that I wouldn't sit in a foxhole with. It's just that simple. I'm not interested in working with you if I wouldn't sit next to you in the middle of the night.
Now, I think that's huge. And I'm glad you said that. And it's something, a mental shift that I have had since we started the podcast and even the last couple of years since we rebranded the firm, where I try to exclusively work with veterans, or if I need a service for my business, I try to find a veteran service provider in lieu of traditional civilian. And sometimes it's hard to do. It's really hard to find a quality veteran in every space. But I think if you can, I think that's one way of giving back to community is helping other veterans grow their businesses. If you especially have a need, if it's a win-win, you have some synergy. I think that's the way to go. And as I'm reaching out to veterans and having first calls and first conversations on LinkedIn, it's one of the first questions I ask them, like, hey, are you involved in the veteran community? And then they'll say whatever they say. And if they say yes, or I want to be more, okay, you're in business today. Yes. Okay. When you are dealing with your customers, are you strategically trying to work with veteran businesses in some form or fashion? Or if you have vendor need, are your vendors veteran owned? If not, why not? Mm-hmm. Is there a stigma? Are you getting a lesser service by working with a veteran owned business, or a higher level of service? So I think having the wherewithal and mindset, I think the mindset question, if you're running your business and you have a choice between working with a civilian, or if you can find a qualified or Yeah, just qualified veteran in that same line of business. What are your thoughts about strategically making the choice to try to work with another veteran-owned business versus a non-veteran-owned business?
Yeah, it's a good question. I would say that many factors, I consider many factors when working with anyone, whether a vendor, a partner, an investor, or one of our client companies. And I would say that being a veteran weighs heavily on the scale for me. Not every veteran is somebody that I want to work with, and there are many civilians that I'm happy to work with. But all things being equal, it's going to be a pretty weighty factor in the scale that I use to make my decision.
I agree. I'm on the same page with you. And it's for a lot of us, it's kind of a shift. So at least for my generation, I don't know about for you, because we got out, or when I got out in the early 2000s, you're on your own, you're just building your business, and you're a veteran. It's kind of it's in the back burner. You didn't want to announce it too much because the negative stereotypes too, that you're going to make everyone do pushups around you all the time. But once you get through that, and then I think with technology, especially LinkedIn now, because you can find veterans in business, you can search your past companies. If everyone doesn't know how to find a veteran on LinkedIn, you just put for whatever industry or location or type of company you're looking for, but in past companies, you put whatever branch or all the branches if you want veterans. That's how I found you. Mm-hmm. So our search is looking at your past company history and found the Marine Corps. I'm like, there we go. There's a devil dog. Let's say hello. And even if we don't know each other, but you just have that instant bond, right? Because if you've been through something, no matter what branch, you've made the decision. You've taken that choice. You made that choice to go and do something to serve your company, your country, excuse me, which is bigger than yourself. And so no matter what branch you're in, Coast Guard, now Space Force, I don't care. You've made that decision. You've done it. So we'll always have that bond. And whether you're successful there or not, doesn't matter. You've done that. So it does help with the relationship forming. It happens very quickly. And especially if you're a veteran, I will actually give you trust until you lose it. Like I start on the high end. I'll give it to you right off the bat. I assume you're a good person. I assume you make good decisions, and maybe you had some rough times of failure. We all have. I have, but I will give you every opportunity. Assume you're up here at this level, and then let you take yourself down by performance otherwise. That's how I see things.
Yeah, I agree with you. I decided some years ago to live my life in service. And so with that as my leading light, then I like to work with people who have also felt that call. And the decision to do something for, as you say, some cause or idea that's bigger than yourself as an individual, that I think is the heart of service. And so I agree with you. And I tend to be on the high trust end of things just naturally, kind of the way I'm drawn.
I appreciate you saying that. And as you're speaking right now, I'm hearing in my mind and feeling that we should probably do another episode talking about your leadership journeys to where you are today that have kind of gotten you here, and the failures and maybe experiences when you try to get things going, and the dynamic of working with your father. That's a whole nother one too. We could probably do a several long hour podcast on the dynamic of working with family and your father, especially. That's a whole dark hole for me that I'm not going to go into. My family didn't make the third generation because of my father and I. And so hopefully, I mean, I'm glad to hear that you did, but there's a lot of dynamic family dynamics where you just can't do that.
Absolutely.
So, but today, I do want to make this a valuable lesson for our listeners on the thought or the idea of capital and sources of capital. Cause I actually had a call with a client earlier this week, and he shared, Brett, I have this idea and it's been on my mind for many years and I want to do something with it. And I'm like, you're going to tell me exactly what it is, but give me the background. And he kind of shared me his idea. I'm like, okay. And we got this and this and this. And he's like, I'm telling myself, if I sell a house, like I have the capital to do it, or I could do this. He's afraid to share his idea with someone because he doesn't want someone to take his idea. I'm like, what have you done with this idea the last 10 or 15 years? And like, you can have this great idea forever. You take it to your grave. An idea without action is nothing.
Yeah.
It's nothing.
100%.
Right. So I shared, you know, there are some successful veterans out there. He's a veteran as well. They have access to capital. He said, I had an idea. And I don't even care if I had an idea, and just to see that idea turn into a reality for me, that's huge. And so even if I only kept 5%, 10% of an amazing idea, but it's my idea and it turned to reality, for me, that's rewarding enough. not always for other people. And I just for this podcast, I had a veteran speak to the other day, which I thought would be a phenomenal guest. And he's like, well, what are your metrics? And what are, who's your listenership? And what's this? And what's the ROI? And like, dude, this costs me money. This costs me money. I'm giving back. I'm just sharing lessons of leadership. I'm not making money on this right now. I pay everybody to be on this. You know, I have a podcast production team. There's technology. There's time. I'm not servicing my clients. I'm doing this. I'm truly doing this to give back, and it's not for money. And so I don't know where I'm going with that. Oh, he just having an idea and then turn that idea into a reality. It can't always be for the money today. And if you ever do anything with it, then it's just an idea that never happened.
Yeah. There is a lot of thinking about this in the startup community and the investment community. And essentially you're right on the money, which is to say that you can be overly protective of your novel idea. It's not uncommon to be overly protective of your novel idea. Novel ideas are not uncommon at all, particularly your first time through. You might think that whatever idea or insight or creation that you've come up with, that it can be stolen from you if you share it. Well, you know, at a practical level, if it can be stolen from you because you shared it, it's probably not going to be defensible over the long run. Let's just start there. So whatever insight that you have through its simple communication abrogates its value, then I would question whether or not it's an especially valuable idea to begin with, or it may be valuable initially, but it's probably not going to be particularly valuable over the long run. The other thing that happens is when you bring your idea to life, you inevitably communicate it to everybody around you. That's one of the requirements of being a leader in a company, is to communicate endlessly about what it is that you're trying to accomplish with your employees, with your customers, with your vendors. If you choose to take on investors, you're going to have to communicate your idea again and again and again. And your biggest problem is not going to be that somebody understands your idea and steals it. The biggest problem is going to be that people only half understand your idea and implement it incorrectly or implement it in ways that you didn't have in mind. You never hear anybody say that something was over-communicated during a project. That's not a common complaint, right? The common complaint is that there was 99% of the time that the challenge is that the communication could have been better.
I completely agree.
Yeah, I think that's a common misconception. And what I would like to give the entrepreneur who feels that way is the comfort and confidence to know that this is not your only good idea. This may not even be your best idea. And by getting it out of the front of your mind and into the world so that it has a chance to live and breathe, you're going to surprise yourself with the other great ideas that are going to come right behind that. Give yourself the freedom to share your ideas. Now, if your idea involves a particular, let's say, piece of code, in the case of technology, you don't have to share your code with everybody, okay? If your idea involves a relationship that's unique, that's going to allow you to have an unfair advantage in the marketplace, you can talk about the relationship without giving the relationship away. So there are ways to share your idea that are not going to take away from the value of that idea. So don't give away your secret sauce, but don't be afraid to talk about what it is that excites you and that you're passionate about.
Yeah, I think those are all phenomenal points. Where I just want to apologize right now because I didn't say, what the heck do you do? So let me take a step back. Everyone's like, okay, we're kind of understanding a little bit about capitalization and ideas. Alex, what do you do?
Let me just say the most important thing I do is be a good husband and father. So I have a beautiful wife of 26 years. I have 5 children, and I would set everything aside in the name of both of those.
That's
but
awesome.
What I do professionally these days, most of the time, is I help entrepreneurs to bring their ideas to life, and I help marry capital to entrepreneurs. So I'm the executive director of Evolution Accelerator. Evolution Accelerator was founded, and I'm a co-founder. I'm not the sole founder. I'm not the sole founder of any of my enterprises. I'm a co-founder of Evolution Accelerator. It was created in 2018 to provide the coaching and connections and capital that entrepreneurs need to succeed. And a little while after we founded Evolution Accelerator, we founded Evolution Ventures, which is a venture syndicate arm that provides capital directly to entrepreneurs at a larger scale than Evolution Accelerator does. And I'm also what they call an investor operator. So I really can't help myself. I have to create a company every now and then when I see a, you know, I have my own set of exciting ideas that I'm passionate about and that I like to bring to reality. These days, I tend to focus principally on my own in the fintech space, the financial technology space. For the last couple of companies that I've helped to co-found, it's really been about either giving creators or small businesses access to the tools that are going to help them to succeed and be able to exit their businesses, and helping the unbanked, the unbankable become banked, have access to banking services so that they can not only take their hard-earned money and put it someplace safe, but they can have access to banking services, which are so essential for successful entrepreneurial activity.
Thank you for clarifying and sharing that. So as you're sharing, my mind's already going. I already have two connections I have to make. I don't care. I have to introduce you, Andrew Deck after this call, and then Chris if I needed to. So I have two connections already have to make for you. So this is what I love, connecting people to make stuff happen.
Me too.
Right? So if I know, if I hear, if things are being triggered when you're chatting with me, connect. I'm going to make those connections and just see what happens. Right. So that's phenomenal. I appreciate you doing that. What is the, cause actually I'll share for myself on LinkedIn, and professionally I manage money once it's there. Right. So once someone has an idea and or they have a liquidity event or they've built a business through maturity and they actually have capital that's not going in the business, cause most entrepreneurs, everything you make goes back in the business first number of years until you've actually, hey, it's growing enough where there's more coming out than is I'm putting in. That's a phenomenal day. Right.
That's and the business cycle, right?
Like, oh my God, there's enough coming out. I can get a little bit of my own liquidity back that I've bled into this company for so many years. That being said, how did you find the fintech, or is that your main area or niche, if I may ask, or how did that kind of happen?
Let's get in the way back machine for a minute. So as I mentioned, I came home in 1995, and my home at the time was Concord, California, which is in the San Francisco Bay Area. And having met my beautiful bride and decided to make a life together, I was in possession of a magazine called The Economist. And The Economist, for your readers who, or your listeners who may not know The Economist, and they're not paying me to say this, it's a fantastic magazine. And I highly recommend investing the time and the money to understand what's going on around you, what's going on around you in the world. And The Economist had a headline in 1995, and the headline said, they're making millionaires in Silicon Valley. And so I showed it to my wife. She wasn't even my wife yet. I came home and I said, look, they're making millionaires in Silicon Valley. We got to go there. And the funny thing is I didn't have any idea where Silicon Valley was. It could have been on the moon. And when I realized that it was only 45 minutes away from me, that was that. We picked up and we headed into Silicon Valley. And I had the honor and the pleasure of being asked to serve as the director of technology for the largest venture capital firm in the world through the height of the dot-com boom. And that was a phenomenal experience. That was something that really dropped into my lap through friends who knew that I was passionate about technology and who knew that I liked to help and that I was a lover of business. And when they had this opportunity come up, they gave me a ring. And honestly, I didn't really know anything about venture capital. I wasn't familiar with the firm. And I made the decision to go there because I was excited about working on engineering projects with in the milieu, which I found myself. So I served as the director of technology for that firm, as well as their mezzanine firm and another venture capital firm through the height of the dot-com boom. And that really set the hook for me.
Okay.
That was the first time that I was ever exposed to capital formation as a business, to the intersection of startups and investors, because my family business was born on a kitchen table. My father's business was born on the kitchen table, and they never took in investors. I didn't know anything about investment. So here I was working very closely with the most successful investors in the world at the height of the dot-com boom. And it was a very exciting time. It was an exciting place to be. It was so educational. It was, you know, as they say, drinking from a fire hose. Then after the dot-com boom was over, my wife and I decided that we wanted to have children. So we decamped to the Sacramento Valley, which is a little distance away. And as I mentioned, we have five children. And so in 2014, my wife gave me the green light to get out of the house and get out from underfoot. And so I went and started my own software company. And that was the first time that I ever took in investment money. And I took it in from friends and family. And we built a product and made a lot of mistakes, a ton of mistakes. I should mention that my life is mostly mistakes, mostly things that I've done wrong or done incorrectly or done inefficiently and learned along the way. And so that software company ended up having a child, giving birth to a joint venture between myself and another individual. And that joint venture was a fintech company in the end. And today that fintech company handles risk management into FDIC insured banks for high risk depositors and has helped to clear, last time I looked, a little bit over $2 billion in transactions. So that's really how I got started, was in a software company that some friends of mine and I decided to create that turned out to be not a perfect match for what we had envisioned, but the software architecture that we had created turned out to be really great for tracking and tracing. And tracking and tracing was an important part of the adult use cannabis industry in 2017 in California. Matter of fact, it was one of the most difficult parts of that industry to satisfy regulatorily. And we were sitting on a piece of software and some architecture that we had been developing for several years that was really a very good match. So we had an unfair advantage. We had a head start coming into that industry. And we went from track and trace to risk management for financial institutions. And now we're in the process of actually becoming a financial institution in that company. So Instead of just providing risk management to banks, we're launching our own bank in that industry.
In cannabis.
That's right. That's right.
So fintech and cannabis. This is actually timely. So I'm actually where you are chatting about discussing. I wasn't going to go there, but I did think about it when you mentioned it earlier. Like, it sounds like cannabis, and it's cannabis. And so myself, not a plug, but it's just something I had to go through because cannabis companies have employees too. And they want to retire too. They want to work and have a good lifestyle and be able to not have to work one day, which is what we all ultimately want. And so the main vehicle most Americans have to do that or help with that after the individual IRA is a company's 401k plan. Mm-hmm. Because all the issues with regulation and the national challenges with cannabis, as you know, banking was a challenge or has been a challenge. I think it is still a challenge unless it's mainstream and I don't know it now.
Continues to be a very important challenge. Absolutely.
Right. So I have a niche or a specialty. Yes, we work with the veterans, but also I work with cannabis too. I don't think I've ever said that before on the podcast channel, but I help companies in the cannabis industry establish and run 401k plans that are compliant, so to speak. And so it's an area maybe we can chat about this offline. I had no idea. This is the great thing about the podcast. Things and people chat, things come up. So I was the first to even experience or go down that path. Most big firms, I mean, I was at several big firms. If you want to do something, especially cannabis, no. Just no. We don't want to touch it. We don't look at it. We'll find our money elsewhere. I was like, guys, we have a process. It seems to work and it's vetted. I have other companies that have done the work and they're there. And I will humbly plug my back office, Independent Financial Partners, for not saying no. Say, Brett, okay, let's dig a little deeper and make sure it's okay. Let's make sure we're comfortable with that. So my back office did their own due diligence. And now that's how I became the number one or the first advisor within my firm to be vetted to be able to do 401ks for cannabis companies in California. So just like you, it's easy to say no, but it's more of a challenge to figure out a way to say yes or to find a yes. So I applaud you for that and just share, like, as you're speaking, I'm remembering my own path last couple of years as we went down this road and it is rewarding and these people do deserve to save for retirement and they want to be able to retire one day and have their own lifestyle. So I applaud you for helping find a banking solution to allow them to run their businesses more like a traditional business and not to worry about some of the challenges that have always plagued the illegal cannabis industry since it's been legalized. So thank you for that.
Well, absolutely. I'm very pleased and honored to be part of helping that industry to participate in a legitimate fashion in the economy. because it's an important agricultural industry and it's filled with real people. So, you know, I mentioned that I like to be of service, and I like to be of service to all of God's people, and they come in all flavors and shapes and sizes, and they work in a wide variety of places. So I think that the opportunity to help take something that has the patina of criminality, the shadow of, what's the right word?
Prohibition. The negative stigma.
Yeah, the negative stigma. And bring that into the light and help people to access traditional banking and participate in paying their taxes, having 401ks, being part of their community, supporting their employees and the causes that they care about. That's something I'm very pleased and proud to be part of. And that experience, taken together with the fact that I've been in technology for 30 years and that I have a tendency to like to be at the front of emerging trends, led me from cannabis later into blockchain. In the same year that we co-founded this banking company, I also established our first crypto fund for friends and family. And I know that crypto has a, you know, kind of an up and down reputation. And for what it's worth for your listeners, we're pleased to operate in the light. And as a matter of fact, we exited that crypto fund in December of 2021. We saw the writing on the wall and it was time to cash in our chips.
Good timing.
And go to something
else.
Yeah.
Good timing there. And for full disclosure for our listeners, I do not endorse blockchain or crypto. My E&O doesn't cover it. So if anyone calls me and wants to talk about crypto, I just have to say my E&O doesn't cover it. So I cannot discuss crypto or blockchain or anything along those lines for investors did that, which is good.
Sure.
So that being said, appreciate that. So actually, my mind, I would love to have you come back, Alex, and go through just the lessons of leadership from 95 through 2017 and all the failures. We can have a failure off and talk about the lessons.
We're going to need
there.
A little while.
Right. Exactly. And then some. What I will ask though, so now having all the experience you've learned and having the flexibility, I want to commend you. You said you started a project, had the company, and then you realized some facets of it were applicable to other industries, and that led to the spinoff, the baby of your other venture. I applaud you for having the flexibility and not being rigid, because that rigidity can destroy businesses. And so this day and age, you have to be more flexible than ever because technology is moving so fast. It's just, as we said in the Marine Corps, Semper Gumby. Gumby's a little green guy. He stretches around, always flexible. And that's Marine Corps. Always be flexible. Which is good.
Sure.
So that being said, if you have your business now and entrepreneurs and they have an idea and they're, should I find a capital investor? Should I not? What's kind of the decision factor, or what are some things, some factors you think an entrepreneur should think about when they're considering whether to bring on a strategic or capital partner?
A really good question. And let me just say, especially for your veteran listeners out there, or maybe people who are not too familiar with the military, it was the military. It's particularly the Marine Corps infantry that taught me the importance of being willing to improvise, adapt, and overcome. That's our informal motto, as you know, in the Marine Corps: improvise, adapt, and overcome. And that's an important part of being an entrepreneur, because the one thing I can promise you is that whatever you think is going to happen is not actually going to happen.
You can say that again.
Yeah.
That's called life. So, that's called life, right?
Yeah. As far as whether or not to take on an outside investor or a capital partner, I think there are a number of things that matter. But first among those, I would put your own personal goals. I would say the most important thing to know is yourself. Understand what your goals are for yourself and for the business that you're creating, or the business that you've created, because you can take on capital at many stages in a business. You can take on capital at the idea stage. You can take it on, let's call it the MVP or minimum viable product stage. You can take it on at the growth stage. And of course, everybody's familiar with the term IPO or public companies. And that's really when you take on capital to become, let's call it a world beater kind of company. So there are many times that you'll have opportunities to consider taking on capital. And I think the most important thing to understand is what your own goals are for yourself and for your business. How do you define success, and how are you going to best operate? Because taking on capital is a topic that a lot of people think very hard about, bringing in investors. And what I like to compare that process to is actually getting married. If you're going to take on an investor, it's like getting married. And for any of your listeners out there who are married, you'll remember how important the wedding seemed before you were married. But the real trick is not getting to the wedding successfully. The real trick is having a successful marriage. So taking on capital looks a lot like getting to the wedding, but it's actually a lot like being married. You have to understand that if you accept someone's money to further the, you know, your commercial interests, you're creating a rest of your life bond with that person. And it's important to understand what it is that you need out of that bond and how it is that you're best going to operate, and to carefully evaluate the individual that you're thinking about getting into this bond with, and asking yourself if you'd like to be in a lifetime bond with this person. Because if not, no amount of money is going to make it worth it.
Those are all very good points. It is a marriage. It's a work marriage.
That's right.
It's a work marriage, period.
That's right.
No ifs, ands, and buts. And it's legal, and there are guidelines. And if you don't follow the rules, just like a regular marriage, if you cheat, there's consequences. If you don't follow the partner agreement or whatever the requirement is, there are consequences. So no one's going to give you money for free. No one's going to take my money and go away. Especially the more money people give you, the more they're going to be looking to make sure they're making a prudent investment. People aren't giving any business owners money because they're bored, right?
That's right.
They're making a capital investment because they want an ROI, and they're betting on you and your business and your skill set and your tenacity and your expertise and your ability to deliver on that investment and have a return on that investment.
That's right. And, you know, it's important to understand that the first couple of times you take money for your company, it's almost certain to be in your friends and family circle. And so now you're creating a situation where at every holiday party, at every birthday, every time you get on the phone to talk to the aunt or uncle or cousin or friend or brother that lent you that money, or they didn't loan it to you, but they invested that money with you, you're now going to be having a conversation about your business and how it's going. And that money's always going to be there. So consider carefully the nature of your relationship with an individual, as well as your own personal character and their character, when deciding whether or not to take money. Later on, you'll start dealing with more professional investors, whether they're professional angel investors or venture capital investors or private equity investors. And then the relationship is more transactional. It's still a lifetime relationship, though. And as you point out, Brett, the more money you take, the deeper the level of commitment that you're going to have to one another, for better or for worse. And remember that most startups don't work out. Mathematically, you're much more likely to lose this money than to return this money. So think about that before you take that money.
All phenomenal points. Do you help companies go through that decision process, or where does your expertise come in if you're chatting with an entrepreneur? Because as I'm reaching out and having conversations with entrepreneurs who are all veterans from LinkedIn, initially, if they're in the smaller or the startup phase, they're all asking me for money. You know, literally, like, I have an idea and they're pitching me. And like, I'm not a bank. I help you once you make your money, right? Mm-hmm. But so sure. A lot of newer investors are trying to figure that out, that they have an idea and they're looking for capital. And so, and one of my designations, I don't know if you heard it or not, actually it's over here, the CEPA, Certified Exit Planning Advisor. So a lot of I went through is like, do you bring an angel investor versus selling to management versus the family dynamic? Because right now in this country, there's the newer companies, entrepreneurs, but also a lot of the baby boomers are still stepping out. And the baby boomers are trying to figure out, like, baby boomers are in their 70s and their kids in their mid-50s. My kid's not ready yet. And then they're mid-50s, right? That's a whole, just the mentality there. So when do you generally get involved, or when do you start having conversations with entrepreneurs about their business and potential growth?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And let me start by framing the life cycle of a business.
Please.
So, you know, a business starts off as an idea or an inspiration with an individual or a small group of individuals. And for the first part of the business life cycle, you're actually worth less than nothing, because you're not even worth nothing. You know, you've invested time and money into your endeavor. And for some period of time, you're actually below the line of having any equity at all having any value at all. And it's not until you identified that great product market fit and figured out how to deliver a product or service that people love and are willing to give you money for as customers. You know, the most important money you'll ever get as an entrepreneur is from your customers, not your investors. Okay. That's one thing to keep in mind. Let me just sidebar for a moment.
Please.
There's actually relatively little merit in taking an investment. So I'm never impressed by people who tell me that they've raised $4 million or $5 million. That just means you've identified $4 or $5 million worth of problems that you need to solve before you can make money. Okay. The real merit is in creating a product or service that people love and that they want to buy from you. That's the real merit. Now that cycle, it looks like it's a line that starts at zero and then goes below zero for some period of time. And then eventually you get back to the point where your company is worth nothing, which is a great feeling because it means that you're at break even. And then from there, you take your company and you begin to grow and begin to be worth less than nothing.
That's your horseshoe.
Yes, that's right. That's right. And where we traditionally get involved in our business cycle. So we're what's known as an accelerator. We're known as angel investors. We are usually involved at the very earliest part of that life cycle. And that's typically called the pre-seed or seed stage of a company. So I'm very often, myself and my partners, we are there during the formation of a company. When a company is actually created, we'll very often be the first investors into the company or the second investors into the company. We'll very often be advisors to the company, whether or not we invest, and we'll be among the first people to be on the ownership table, which is called a cap table or capitalization table. So I like to be there during the earliest parts of the company. I think that's when it's most exciting. That's also when the risks are highest and the opportunity for rewards are typically highest. You know, risk and reward are the two sides of the same coin.
Yes.
So I tend to be there at the very earliest part of formation.
I think that's interesting. Then how are you finding, or how are people finding you? I know you've been around for 30 years. Is it your reputation? It's all the work you've done for many years, or how do people find you? How do people know about you? How do people know to have a conversation with you?
Yeah, that's a very good question. The most important thing is your network. That's the most important thing. And your network is nothing more or less than the relationships that you've built and that you have put time into. Sometimes people confuse the fruits of the garden with gardening. And building a network is gardening. It's the act of putting seeds in the ground and tilling the earth and putting in the time and the care for months or years sometimes to create relationships that then turn into trees that bear fruit. And so it's easy to mistake the companies, which are the fruit of the tree, or the opportunities that turn into return on investment, which is the harvest. It's easy to mistake those things for the act of deciding to be a gardener. So I'm a gardener would be the easiest way to understand that, Brett. And the people around me are gardeners. Everybody that I work with has a heart of service. We all set out to help people. And as we've all helped people over many, many years, those people have come to know and trust us. And when opportunities present or they have friends that need help, then those opportunities are typically brought to us. They're introduced to us. And then we go through a pretty structured process to understand the caliber of the individual that we've been introduced to and understand the merits of their idea and try to help that person. 9 times out of 10, our help is free. It's like you in this podcast. It's something that we do as a service. And even when we invest in that 10th opportunity, only a couple of those opportunities ever manifest into what you would call return on investment. So it'd be safe to say that the people around me spend 95% of their time gardening because it's something that they want to do. We try to make ourselves useful to people around us. And that heart of service is something that comes with you. It travels with you everywhere you go. It shows in all of your relationships, whether they're familial or professional or social. And people know and respond to that. And they recognize that when there's an opportunity that needs to be sussed out, when there's an entrepreneur who needs to be helped, then because you've been a good gardener and you've been a trustworthy partner in these relationships, they bring them to you, and then you have your opportunity to actually do the capital part of it,
right?
Which is what most people are paying attention to.
So when you share with me, so you're coming in the super early phases, even when it's an idea, it's not even a company yet. How do you then, is there a normal amount there? Is someone looking for, and I'm just thinking out loud, is it 10 grand? Is it 50 grand? Is it 100, half a million? Like what are, when a company's so new, it's just an idea, there's nothing if it's just an idea. I mean, there's no customers, there's no contracts, there's no assets, there's no liabilities, and there's no infrastructure. So how do you think, okay, this idea is worth X as a seed, and you're going to take some ownership? And what is, maybe I'm asking several questions at once, is there a normal, hey, for me to provide this angel seed money to get you off the table because you're getting ramen noodles, but you have a phenomenal idea, you know, am I taking 80%? Am I taking 20%? Am I watching Shark Tank? Like, what's the thought process? Because I know people are kind of thinking about that. That's a lot at once, but that's where my mind's going. So hopefully that's okay.
Sure. Well, I'll try to unpack those things.
Yeah, sorry. My mind starts going and it all comes out.
So let's start with an understanding. And the most important understanding here is that your time is always worth more than your money. Your time is always worth more than your money. So, you know, they say in battle, there are two factors, right? Time and space. And only one of them is, you know, you can never get it back. So money can create space, but it cannot create time. Time is the most important thing that you have as a prospective investor or as an entrepreneur. So before you ever ask yourself whether or not you'd write a check to it, you ask yourself whether or not you'd spend time with it. Because time is irreplaceable. And as far as the amounts that are typically involved in seed funding, let me start by giving you a database answer. So according to the Angel Capital Association, which is the largest association of angel investors in the United States, and therefore I think the world, about 75% of the seed and pre-seed deals are at $250,000 or less. Now, when you're at the very earliest part of a company, it can be considerably less than that. Sometimes it can be the $3,000 that somebody needs to hire an attorney and set up their books and get started on their idea. Sometimes it can be the $5,000 or $10,000 that they need to produce their first prototype and get rolling. Sometimes it can be the line of credit that they need with a manufacturer in order to get their first prototype out the door. And that manufacturer may not want to deal with an entrepreneur who has no work history, but they know you and they're willing to let you take on that responsibility on behalf of the entrepreneur. So there are many, many ways to contribute early on that are low cost for angel investors.
Let me ask about that though. So if you come to me or someone comes to me and with an idea and I can't afford $3,000 to launch the business, what does that show about my past financial acumen and my past financial decisions? If someone doesn't have $3,000, should they be starting a company in the first place? We've all been in some rough spots, but I mean, sure. That's what my mind's thinking, right? If you don't have $3,000 saved up. Like for me right now, where I go to, the company's engaged me to hire their 401k. Unless it's a startup in cannabis, that's different. But if someone or a company already has existing plan and they're coming to me, I just look at my own personal 401k. If my personal 401k is bigger than the company 401k,
we
got some things to chat about. And so that's kind of a metric for me. When mine's my own personal one, and I've only been working professionally 20 some odd years, if my personal 401k is larger than the company's, like, what does that say about your company? You know, where's your priorities and what are your employees' priorities and where's your priority been over time? So just a thought there. So if someone's coming to you, I need $3,000 to get my articles of incorporation figured out and I can't go to E-Minutes or something like that, a tech legal firm to do it, or Zoom Legal, right? Is that a company you want to invest $3,000 with? I don't know. Is it?
It's a really good question and it's absolutely worth thinking about. And the way that I would evaluate that is by looking at the individual, because what if we're talking about somebody who's just come out of college, somebody who has student debt? What if we're talking about somebody whose responsibilities to this point in life have included taking care of their family members? or helping their brother, sister, mother, father, aunt, or uncle survive in this world. So there are a lot of reasons why you might have a really good idea and not a lot of capital with which to start. And I'm going to distinguish that from, you know, somebody who's maybe later along in life and probably should have made some decisions that are going to create the opportunities to put aside some capital for your future ideas. And just recognize that providence works in mysterious ways. And I'm going to try to avoid being especially judgmental about the individual in front of me based on their outward characteristics, which include the size of their bank account, right? I'm going to try to
measure. Feedback. No, it's great. It's good perspective. I'm going to try to measure
people on their internal characteristics.
No, I think that's phenomenal. And you answered my question directly, and I like your answer a lot. So I appreciate you sharing that perspective. That's a great thing about these calls. You hear different perspectives. That's probably baseball talk. I'm not supposed to have baseball talk. Our podcast guy don't have baseball talk. I don't even know what inside baseball talk is, but I think I just did. I'm not supposed to do it, which is probably more inside baseball talk. So we'll stop.
I think that's where you get the most interesting talks, Brett, is when you're just really sitting down and talking heart to heart with people. So I enjoyed it.
Yeah, no, I do too. Is there then, and thank you for sharing the range too, 3,000 to under a quarter million. That provides a lot of perspective for a lot of entrepreneurs. What is the one or two things you think or you see with your experience that seed money goes to the most? Is it possible to generalize, or do you see, hey, normally we give this seed capital or ultra seed capital, it's applied to these things?
Yeah, there's a concept in the investment community, particularly the angel investment community, and it's called the use of fund. And the use of funds is a specification by the entrepreneur as to what they plan to do with the money. And the use of funds will very often go to topics like product development, marketing, administrative, legal support. Those are typically the places where you'll see the use of, you know, an intelligent use of funds. And, you know, there are some things that you want to watch out for there as an investor, as an entrepreneur. Probably the most important thing in the technology space that you want to be careful about doing is not buying the technology for the idea. So if an entrepreneur comes to me with a software company idea, an idea for software as a service or a software tool, that's something that I deal with quite a bit in the fintech space. And their plan is to take $100,000 or $200,000 and give 70% of it to a developer who's going to build the tool or product for them that's going to make their idea a reality, that's a big red flag. It's a big red flag. I call that prepaying your hostage taker. So it's important when you're dealing in particularly the technology world, but I would say more generally in any kind of early investment, it's important that the right people be in the team to begin with to create a successful enterprise. And here I rely very heavily on the work of a good friend of mine, Ernesto Ciroli. Ernesto Ciroli and the Trinity of Management. So it's worth talking with your audience about the Trinity of Management. The Trinity of Management is this idea that there are three separate important people in any early enterprise. And they're not the, let me tell you who the people are, but let me start by saying, there is no one individual that is all three people. Okay. No matter how intelligent you are, no matter how gifted and creative you are, you're going to tend to fall into one of these three kinds of people, and you need to find the other two before you really are going to be ready to launch your enterprise. And the first kind of person and the most common kind of person that we see in the entrepreneurial world is a product-based person. This is somebody who really has a clear idea of what it is they want to create, whether it's a product or a service or a blend of products and services. But they know what it is that the world needs, and they must create this thing. They're driven to create this thing. That's the most common kind of entrepreneur that you see, particularly when you're dealing with the topic of investment and angel investment. The next kind of entrepreneur that is in that triangle is what we call the market person. And I want to be very careful here to distinguish between marketing, which is another kind of product, and a market-based person, which is a personality type. the market person in your enterprise needs to be that individual who's got to shake 100 hands today, who has to talk to people and learn about what's important to them and what their needs are, and who's committed to helping people meet their needs, whether or not it has anything to do with the product or service that they're selling. So you've got these market-based individuals. And, you know, you get a lot of really successful market-based individuals in my experience from network marketing. These are people who are committed to having strong networks and strong relationships and understanding what the needs are of the people around them. So now you got to have somebody who's committed to delivering that perfect product or service. And you got to have somebody who's committed to understanding customers and what they really want and need. And then the third leg of that triangle is the F part of the leg. So you have product, market, and finance. And the finance person is actually the least common type of entrepreneur. You almost never see finance-based entrepreneurs in the startup world, because finance-based entrepreneurs tend to be in your neck of the woods, Brett. They tend to be wealth managers. They tend to be CPAs. They tend to be accountants. So if you have a friend whose bills are always paid, whose checkbook is always balanced, who knows exactly how they're going to meet all of their financial obligations for the next 90 days or 180 days or 2 years, and they've got some free time this afternoon and they're going to go play golf or they're going to go fishing or they're going to go pursue their personal interests, and they tend to be fairly risk averse, that's the financial part of the three-part triangle that Ernesto Ciroli described. So what we typically see then is we typically see product-based entrepreneurs, and they don't know yet that they need a market partner. They think that if they build this product or service, customers will find them. And that is a very big, very common mistake. The second kind of entrepreneur that we often see is a market-based entrepreneur who knows that their customers and their friends need something, but they haven't yet found their product-based partner that can create that for them. And then when you get those two together, and they're the two most important parts of that startup trifecta, then you got to find that finance-based person who's going to keep them both firmly grounded to reality, who's going to make sure that all of the legal, tax, accounting, bookkeeping, et cetera, obligations are being met in a timely fashion. Because, you know, no matter how passionate you are about your product or your market, when you decide to launch a company, especially if you decide to take in outside investment, there is a forest of regulations that you need to comply with. And you need that part of your business to be filled by your friend who tells you this is crazy and it's never going to work, but I'll help you anyway. That's your finance-based friend.
Right. No, that's I'm so glad you went through that, and so many people don't realize that. And at the same time, if someone's trying to give you a different perspective, you can't take it personally. It's always about understanding, and there is and or can be more than one perspective. I think I saw kind of a meme a month or two ago. Someone had one side had a sphere for a circle to go through or a ball to go through. The other side was a square. And so, but if you look at the sphere from one angle, it's a circle. From the other, it's a square. And so it's both. It can be both. So understanding that, being open to it and realizing, you know, you may be the yin and you need a yang, right? And to put it all together is the ultimate goal there, and having the fortitude to understand that. And not being overly headstrong as a veteran, I think is huge. So building that team. So I think what you're saying is building the right team and having the wherewithal to recognize who those players are and who's going to fill that need on your team.
That's right. And to come all the way back to one of your earlier questions, that's why you'll hear recurrently among seed, stage, and pre-seed investors that we're really investing in the team. That's really very true. Because experience teaches us that it takes more than one person to make a company. And there is no one person who has everything that it takes.
No, and acknowledging that and then surrounding yourself with those people and or finding the capital to help you be able to surround yourself with those people is huge. So this is good. I think actually we've probably gone over longer than we should, but this is good. And so I do want to have you back on again for another episode to talk about leadership. But I have one kind of final question where I think many entrepreneurs that are going down this path are asking themselves is, when is it okay? You're talking about use of funds for the entrepreneur who's maybe not quite living out of the trunk of their car, but is having a tough time. They're not living extravagantly. Everything's the business. They are eating ramen noodles. They're probably living well. Their means are their means, but everything's going the business and you get some capital. When is it okay for you to like take a deep breath and just enhance your own lifestyle as that entrepreneur after giving so much for so long and taking nothing in return? When is that moment? Is there a moment, or do you see, cause I could see even most investors or entrepreneurs are so used to not doing anything for themselves, but doing it all for the business. When is it okay? Is it a mental shift? Is there a certain point? Is there a trigger, or it just happens? Like, what is your experience in that realm where you're dealing with an entrepreneur who has nothing and it's all in the business to, hey, it's okay if I actually buy a steak tonight?
Yeah, that's a really, really good question. And to kind of, you know, parlay from our immediately prior topic, it's this topic of emotional resilience. And emotional resilience comes hand in hand with maturity. And what you have to ask yourself is, are you being honest with your investor about what it is that you need the money for? And what does your investor want for you in this business? Because I think an investor should want more than return on investment, should want more than return on capital. They should want somebody to be healthy and happy and well-balanced and mature and emotionally resilient at the center of that company. There are lots and lots of examples in the press today of people who create return for their investors, but they do it in a way that's unhealthy. They do it in a way that's ungrounded. And eventually they end up sabotaging their own companies because they're not well internally. They're not physically, financially, mentally, emotionally, spiritually well. So I think it's okay to use your investors' resources to be healthy, because ultimately that's an important part of being an effective leader. It's an important part of building a sustainable enterprise, is to be in a place of emotional, financial, physical, spiritual, mental health. And so if you need to eat a meal that's well balanced, maybe you don't need steak. Maybe you need a hamburger. But if you've been eating, you know, nothing but top ramen for the last 3 months and you can't think straight, how are you going to be of value to the people that need you to be of value? And not just your investors, but how about your life partner, who's also probably sacrificing right alongside of you? How about your kids? How about your employees? How about your co-founders? They all need you to be in a healthy place. And I think the key is to have the kind of relationship with your investors where you can talk about that honestly, where you can say, hey, you know, I'm living out of the trunk of my car, as you put it, Brett, and I need to have a bed and a roof and some food to eat. I don't have to live in a palace. I don't have to have a, you know, a mansion and a yacht, but I need to have the right grounding to succeed in this enterprise, because starting your enterprise is really, it's a marathon. You're not going to exit your enterprise in 6 months or 8 months or 9 months or 18 months. If things go well, you're going to exit your enterprise in a few years, and it could be considerably longer than just a couple of years. And throughout that journey, you need to be in a place that's well grounded. And that starts by taking care of your body and your mind and your spirit. And sometimes you need to use a little bit of investor money to do that. Sometimes you need to use a little bit of investor money to take care of your people. And I think it's important to understand and keep those things in balance. So emotional resilience and maturity are going to be the keys to understanding when it's okay to do that. And communication is absolutely essential for maintaining that trust with your investor. And no smart investor wants you starving to death while you're doing it. That's not to their benefit. And it's ultimately not the way that the people that I work with want to, it's not the kind of enterprise that any of us want to support.
It's good. People. And I appreciate you sharing that perspective. I just know, I can only speak for myself. I would just feel, and for my own business, I've run it all myself I've never taken outside investment, full disclosure. I've borrowed over using my existing assets that I've built out as a W-2 employee to have funding and capital. So I guess I'm self-capitalized, but there are times I can envision, because we're taught and we live selfless service. That selfless is not you. You're kind of the last person, but it does make sense. You got to take care of yourself before you take care of others. You know, some people say, a good analogy, especially Giselle loves to work out and she's a coach too at a gym. You know, a lot of people, I don't have time to work out. I'm too busy working. I'm too busy being a parent. And so I don't have time to go to the gym. I don't have time to go for a run. I don't have time. Well, that you are your time. And by you're not sharpening the saw, quoting Stephen Covey back in the day, 7 habits of highly effective people. You have to work out because it helps you be able to think more clearly and perform at a higher level mentally and professionally. So it's not either or, it has to be included in. And so I just know so many veterans that would feel, if I'm taking this money, I can't take any of that money, right? It has to go to all these other areas because they don't want to feel selfish by taking some of that, even though they probably should, to help them get in a better position. So just, that's what I was kind of thinking there and how to think through it. And so this has been a phenomenal episode where I'm learning. And I'm sure our other veteran entrepreneurs that are going through this process are trying to think when they need help or when they should get for help or have an idea that could even merit a potential investment are huge. And I think just thinking about ideas, I think you and I could do another episode again to go over the different types of investors. Maybe it is the family. Well, is the family the right dynamic? You got two kids. One's willing, one's not. One's able, one's not. Like, what about the family dynamic? And then management team. Do you have if you want to step out of the business in the future, is your management team of quality where they can take over? Can they own it? Is it ESOP, employee stock ownership plan? Is that a potential versus having a strategic buyer or an angel investor? There's so many channels out there that I would love to have you back, Alex. We can keep this going another time. So I'm just telling you right now, I'm going to invite you back again. We're going to do another episode, which I hope you're okay with.
I would be honored.
Great. Awesome. Well, everyone, hey, thanks so much. It's been a great episode. Alex, how does someone reach you if they do want to reach you?
You can always find me on LinkedIn, and I've given Giselle my LinkedIn address. The accelerator that I run is Evolution Accelerator, and it's in El Dorado Hills, California. You can find us at evolutionacceleration.com. We're pretty easy to locate. And I'd like to close on one
thing.
Please,
yes, you close.
Your entrepreneurs out there. I'd like to remind anybody who's listening to this podcast and who's thinking about seeking investment, it can often feel like a very frustrating experience because most of the people who look for investment, they don't get it. Most companies don't actually get investment. And that experience of being rejected or investment can be really deleterious to your own sense of self-worth. And, you know, it could be easy to get confused and think that it's about finding the money when actually the money is here to find you. This entire ecosystem exists because we're looking for gold in a gold mine, and you, the entrepreneur, are the gold that we're looking for. So never lose sight of what's really important in this particular equation. You, the entrepreneur, are what is important. It's your idea, your creativity, your passion that's going to change the world. And just because somebody doesn't see it, or their interests don't align with your interests, or their thesis isn't your thesis, that doesn't have anything to do with your self-worth and your value. You're inherently valuable, and what you do matters. So keep on going and believe in yourself.
Alex, that's great. Let's just end on that note. So everyone, thanks so much for spending the last hour or so with us on this Veteran Entrepreneur Masterclass, the podcast, but you can reach out to us at the Strategic Wealth Endeavor website, swe90.com. So this is great. Appreciate you being on here, providing your leadership mentorship. I can't even think, it's been such a long day, which is great. But let's get you back here so you can share more tidbits and more information to help our fellow veteran entrepreneurs. Alex, thanks so much for being here.
My pleasure, Brett. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Veteran Entrepreneur Masterclass podcast. Don't forget to click the follow button to become notified when new episodes become available. Securities offered through IFP Securities LLC, DBA Independent Financial Partners, IFP, member FINRA, and SIPC. Investment advice offered through IFP Investors LLC, DBA Independent Financial Partners, IFP, a registered investment advisor. IFP and Strategic Wealth Endeavor INC are not affiliated. The views expressed are that of the host and are for informational purposes only, and in no event should be construed as an offer to buy or sell securities. Opinions expressed are subject to change without notice and do not take into account the particular investment objectives, financial situation, or needs of individual investors. Neither IFP Investors LLC, IFP Securities LLC, DBA Independent Financial Partners, IFP, nor their affiliates offer tax or legal advice. Interested parties are strongly encouraged to seek advice from qualified tax and/or legal experts regarding the best options for your particular circumstances. The information given herein is taken from sources that IFP Advisors LLC, DBA Independent Financial Partners.